This week's class we're going to be having a look at Majjhima 91, the Brahmayu Sutta, which is a very lovely discourse which goes into quite some length as to the personal behaviour and so on of the Buddha, and a story about a Brahmin whose student Uttara followed behind the Buddha and stalked him, basically an account of a stalker, and gave a detailed account of how he'd lived and so on. So as we can see, this has two full correspondences, one in the Majjhima Agama Sarvasivadin text, Majjhima Agama 161, and also in an independent Chinese translation, Taisho 76, Sutra number 76, which is one of the independent Majjhima style suttas appended to the Majjhima Agama in the Taisho canon. In addition to those two, there is in existence a number of Sanskrit fragments from the finds at Turfan, and these documented here. As usual, we'll be using Venerable Analeo's essay to examine the differences and similarities with the other versions of the text. But let's just start out reading some of the text for now. On one occasion, so we'll mainly use Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, most of which is available in the online version on Google Books. Unfortunately, not all of it is, so for some parts we'll have to rely on another translation. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was wandering in the Videhan country with a large sangha of bhikkhus, with 500 bhikkhus. Now, Videha is where exactly Videha is Videha just north of Vaisali, probably part of the Vajjayan Republic here, and Mithila itself is just up around here somewhere, not far from sort of northwest of Vaisali, probably a little bit northwest of Vaisali. Yeah, so it's up around here. Mithila being a old city, one which was prominent in the Brahmanical tradition before the time of the Buddha, and features in a number of Upanishads, where we find quite a few religious and philosophical dialogues. In fact, the great King Janaka, who's one of the best-known kings in the Upanishads, also featured in the Buddhist Jataka stories, was the king of Mithila, and probably was a real king. There's still a Janakpur in the area, and he was probably the real king there only a few generations before the Buddha. So, on that occasion, the Brahmin Brahmayu was living at Mithila. He was old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, and come to the last stage. He was in his 120th year. He was a master of the three Vedas, with their vocabularies, liturgy, phonology, and etymology, and the histories as a fifth. So this is a standard description of an aged and respectable Brahmin, and has the description of the Vedic literature most prominent at the time of the Buddha. So interesting to see what this exactly is. First thing is to note is that it has the three Vedas, and in the early Buddhist literature always has the three Vedas, which is the Rig Veda, the Saman Veda, and the Yajur Veda. Brahmanical tradition today acknowledges four Vedas, the fourth one being the Atharva Veda, But the Atharva is mentioned a few times in the Buddhist scriptures as the Atharva, and the Atharva is somewhat later than the other ones and wasn't accepted as canonical in the time of the Buddha. So you've got this kind of gradual process of canonizing the scriptures. So the Atharva Veda is actually an interesting one because, like some of the Buddhist scriptures, it's actually not dissimilar in situation to the Jataka stories, where you have a kind of lower, lesser, outside and marginal teachings from the Vedic tradition, a lot of which is to do with black magic and all kinds of strange things, which was probably rejected from the reformist movement or the earlier Vedic movement, but nevertheless in many cases might actually have older roots. So even though it was canonized and accepted as a formal text at a later date, a lot of the material in the Atharva Veda is actually, may at least have roots in even older sources. Difficult to judge that, but this is the three Vedas. In at least one of the Chinese versions, mentions the four Vedas as being reflective of a later editorial stage, together with the Sanigandha Ketu Bhanam Sakharapabheranam Itihasa Panchamanam. Okay, so this is the description of the Vedic literature as known in the Buddha's time and translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi as the vocabularies, the liturgy, I think is the Ketubha, phonology, Sakharapabheranam, Sakharapabheranam is the phonology and etymology, and the histories as a fifth. So it's a slightly curious idiom here, but what it seems to mean is the fifth as following the vocabularies, liturgy, phonology and etymology, and the histories are the fifth sort of ancillary practice. Now notice that the word for histories here is itihasa. Now itihasa literally means as it was, something like that, so that is as it was. It's very similar in form to the phrase iti wuttaka, which is found in Buddhist literature as a term for a class of discourses, itihasa, and basically means it's an idiom that sort of conjures up an idea of, oh, that's how it was in the old days. It's a slightly archaic sounding form, and it probably refers to legends and may well be early versions of legends such as the ones we know today as the Ramayana and Mahabharata and other literature. Okay, skilled in philology and grammar. Philology, padako, and grammar, vyakarana. He is fully versed in natural philosophy and the marks of a great man. So the word Bhikkhu Bodhi is translated as natural philosophy is the word lokayata, and because it's got the word loka or world in it, it's been translated in a number of different ways. Probably, and I think Bhikkhu Bodhi may have revised his translation from this particular form, but it seems that most likely it means cosmology. And then the Mahapurisa Lakhanesu is the marks of a great man, and of course this being one of the main topics of the Brahmayu Sutta itself, and the marks of a great man being very kind of mysterious thing, but we'll have a look at a bit of a look at them later on. But the main thing to note here is that the marks of a great man are said to be, and this is consistent through the whole Buddhist literature, they are said to be a branch of Brahmanical learning, and as such they're something you really have to learn. They're not just, you know, they're obviously physical marks in a certain sense, but they're not kind of obvious things you just have to kind of look at, but there's something that need to be studied in detail. One would guess that there'd be whole branches of sort of omenology together with them that they would be said to symbolize various kinds of things. The Pali tradition, the commentarial tradition, claims that there were 12,000 texts dealing with the Mahapurisa Lakhanas, and curiously enough, not a single one of those texts survives. And this is one of the most curious things about this whole teaching on the characteristics of a great man, is that The Buddhist texts make a reasonably big deal about it and attribute them to the Vedic, or to the Brahmanical and Vedic tradition, and as you see, putting them in together with the major branches of Vedic learning. All of those other branches of Vedic learning are attested, and we have many examples of all of those things, and we know that that's exactly the kinds of things that the Brahmins were studying and the texts that they did preserve. And yet somehow these 12,000 texts on the Mahapurusa Lakana have disappeared without a single trace in the Brahmanical tradition. I'm not aware of a single reference anywhere to this group of characteristics, although there are lots of other characteristics and there are some things that overlap. So it is a rather curious phenomenon as to whether they were actually an authentic Brahmanical teaching or not. Generally speaking, most of the things we find when the Buddhist texts represent Brahmanical or Jaina teachings, generally speaking, they're fairly accurate. They certainly talk about things that are recognisable characteristics of those religions. But here we have this particular teaching, and it just seems to be floating in the middle of nowhere. Anyway, we'll have a bit more of a look at them later on. Now, the Brahman Brahmayu, of course, Brahmayu is word means long-lived Brahman, Brahma, and life, the life of Brahma. The recluse Gotama, the son of the Sakyans who went forth from the Sakyan clan, has been wandering in the Videhan country with the Sangha of 500 bhikkhus. Now, a good report of that master Gotama has been spread about to this effect. Blessed one, Gotama is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened and blessed. He declares this world with its gods, its Maras and its Brahmas, this generation with its recluses and Brahmins, with its princes and people, which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. He teaches the Dhamma that is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing. And he reveals a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. Now it is good to see such arahants. Now that time the Brahman Brahmayu had a young Brahman student named Uttara, who was a master of the three Vedas and likewise fully versed in all the Brahmanical scriptures. Brahmayu told his student, "My dear Uttara, the recluse Gotama has come. Now it's good to see such arahants. Come, my dear Uttara, go to the recluse Gotama and find out whether the report spread about him is true or not, and whether Master Gotama is one such as this or not. Thus we shall know about Master Gotama through you." And so here's the question, Yari wa tang bhagavan tang gotamang tatha santam yeva saddo abhughanto, Yari wa no tatha, Yari wa so bhavan gotamo thadiso, Yari wa na thadiso. Okay, so this is this idiom used in Pali, Yari wa no tatha. Whether he is like that, Yadiva no tata, whether he is not such, Yadiva so tariso, of such a sort, Yadiva nat tariso, or whether he is not of such a sort. Okay, so then Uttara says, "How shall I find out whether the report spread about Master Gotama is true or not, and whether Master Gotama is one such as this or not?" To which Brahmayu replies, "My dear Uttara, the 32 marks of a great man have been handed down in our hymns, and the great man who is endowed with them has only two possible destinies, no other." So here's the phrase here, agatani ko tata Uttara amhakan mantesu. So they have come down, agatan, in the manta, in literally the mantras. So in the Pali text, when they use the word manta, or which we're familiar with in the word mantra, we tend to use it these days, mantra, to mean a meditation word or phrase that's used in meditation. In the scriptures, in the Pali scriptures, manta is used exactly in this sense, which means it's referring to the Vedic literature. And the word agatani is just another form of the word which we're more familiar with in as agama. So as you may know, that the Buddhist scriptures, the early Buddhist suttas, are collected in the most commonly known in the Pali tradition as the Nikayas, and in the Chinese and Sanskrit traditions most commonly called the agamas. So the use of the word agama is derived from passages like this. Okay, this is just a past participle of the same form. My personal feeling is that the word agama is actually a better word to use than nikayas, because nikaya is very a bit confusing, since it's also the name of a school of Buddhism is also called a nikaya, so it gets a little bit confusing. But also because the word agama is older, as we see here, is actually used in the Pali text itself, whereas nikaya is not used in that sense. The Pali tradition actually uses, the commentarial tradition uses both agama and nikaya. When speaking generically about the collections of early suttas, it's perhaps better to use the word agama rather than nikaya. It translates as it's been translated here. The 32 marks have been handed down in our hymns. So hymns being translation of mantra, so agama being what's been handed down, the traditional texts or scriptures. Probably best is translated as scripture. Yeah. What has come down?
If it's oral, it's not scripture, it's just oral.
And it's also not handed, I guess.
Text
is very general, though, especially if you're a postmodernist.
It's oral tradition, it's not.
Well, you can say use the word text in an oral tradition. Mm. That's right. Scripture is more specific, is scribed. But still, I personally think even though scripture literally is what's scribed, I think it's still usable. We use it so much in the sense of, you know, it's the ancient religious text. So that's really the main characteristic of it. Okay. And the great man who is endowed with them has only two possible destinies, no other. If he lives the home life, he becomes a wheel-turning monarch, a righteous king who rules by the Dhamma, master of the four quarters, all victorious, who has stabilized his country and possesses the seven treasures, to wit, the wheel treasure, the elephant treasure, the horse treasure, the jewel treasure, the woman treasure, the steward treasure, and the counselor treasure as the seventh. His children, who exceed 1,000, are brave and heroic, and crush the... I'll just read that sentence again. His children, who exceed 1,000, are brave and heroic, and crush the armies of others. Over this earth, bounded by the ocean, he rules without a rod, without a weapon, by means of the Dhamma. But if he goes forth from the home life into homelessness, he becomes an accomplished one, a fully enlightened one, who draws aside the veil in the world. But I, my dear Uttara, am the giver of the hymns, you are the receiver of them. So this is the classic description of the two destinies that the Mahapurisa, the great man, has. And I think we discussed in the Jataka stories that this is actually the classical decision which the Buddha in his past lives, according to the depiction in the Jataka stories, has had to make countless times, again and again and again. He makes this choice. Is he going to be a householder and live a good worldly life, or is he going to go forth as a rishi, as a sage? And he's made one or other of these choices many times, and very often in the Jatakas we see that he negotiates these choices with a degree of flexibility. For example, he maybe goes forth into the Himalayas, but he maybe goes with his family. In some cases, goes with the whole village or the whole city. Even the whole country goes forth. And they end up, I don't know why they bother going forth if they're all there, but they do, and they go forth and set up a huge hermitage in the Himalaya. Or alternatively, he might live as a rishi's life in the city or in the town, for example, in the garden of the king. So there are various ways of negotiating this whole kind of thing. In some cases, he, as we're familiar with the story of the Buddha in this life, that he left his family and went forth, and as in one much less well-known story in the Jatakas has it, as pointed out by Bhikkhuni Sudama, that in one case he got left with the kids, okay, as the missus went off to go forth, and left him looking after the kids as well. So this happens. So there are all these different variations. But the essential choice is still there, that there are these two ways of living, and that ultimately, in some sense, you're going to have to choose between them. And it's a very interesting depiction of human potential, one which is not presented so clearly in Western literature and Western mythology, even though that choice is still there in some degree, it's not so central and it's not so clear. And for example, in the Gilgamesh myth, which was very popular throughout Babylon and so on, Gilgamesh first meets his great friend Enkidu, and they go on adventures together. Eventually Enkidu is killed, and Gilgamesh, in great grief, goes forth on his journey to find the secret of immortality. So he's like gone first on his worldly adventures as a king, and then goes on the search for immortality. He fails in his search for immortality, and has to be content to be merely a great king. So that same and a builder of cities. So that same kind of choice is, in a sense, present there in the Gilgamesh myth, as it is in many other stories, but not presented in the same sort of clearly distinguished way. So the wheel-turning monarch is obviously a mythic figure who is described in some details in certain of the Buddhist suttas, and obviously there's a whole mythic dimension to this. It is, I suppose, meant to be influential of actual historical kings, and certainly King Ashoka, probably Kanishka, and other Buddhist kings have attempted to live up to the ideal of the wheel-turning monarch, to be able to rule particularly without violence. Okay, so there's this kind of curious dichotomy here, is children kind of crush the armies of others, and yet he rules without a rod and a weapon. So you've got this kind of, it's a little bit similar to the American coat of arms? Doesn't the American coat of arms, he's got the eagle in one hand, one claw, he's got an olive branch, and the other one a clutch of arrows? Yeah? So this is a kind of a similar kind of symbolism here, that, we'd really like to rule without any violence, but, you know, there are these thousand suns over here, so better watch out.
What does wheel turning have to do with the Aryans?
I would say most likely that's the ultimate.
It's got wheel treasure.
Yeah. That's the ultimate meaning of the wheel. In the second millennium BC, in India, it's generally understood that the Indians had a four-wheeled ox-drawn cart, whereas the Aryans had a two-wheeled horse-drawn chariot. Which is what enables them to basically do a kind of blitzkrieg kind of thing. And so the wheel was very much a symbol of power, and it may well be that that's the ultimate meaning of it, although there's also evidence that the wheel, as in the discus, was used as a weapon. And there's Vedic passages that clearly refer to the use of the wheel as a weapon. Now, the wheel treasure is something which appears in the sky. It's a sort of magical wheel thing that appears in the sky. It's described in detail in a couple of suttas. And the king follows it as it rolls across the country. And everyone bows down, and all the peoples of the different lands submit to the rule of the king. So it certainly has a sort of conquering kind of implication there.
Sounds like a starship or something. No.
Exactly, yes. It is, and I think the alien connection has not been investigated seriously enough. Yeah, the wheel-turning monarch, I think, was quite possibly a flying saucer thing going on there. Yeah, look, absolutely. Yeah. So these different treasures and so on are treated in detail elsewhere in the suttas. So I won't go into them in detail just here. We'll get to them eventually. And so in a sense, so that I think what's going on here, if the Buddha's made this choice, and also just to come back to that choice, is that choice is like as an element of a hero, or the element of a larger than life figure, a leader, and a symbolic hero and leader of people. That choice is in a magnified sense the same choice that we all have to make. So we all make that same choice in terms of, do we live in a household or do we live a life gone forth? And we also make the choice in little ways every day, that we decide, am I going to do this thing to serve in the community, or am I going to go into seclusion and just meditate by myself in the forest? So in a sense, we're making the same kind of choice again and again. Yeah, very much so. Yeah. And which is, I think, why the giving up of it, like the vulnerability of giving up those things, is the greater gift.
Was the Indian Rishi tradition, Sanana tradition, and then Buddhism, you know, that's the Indian renunciate, that choice,
yeah,
where it's very, very clear,
mm-hmm,
home life or renunciation. Is that the only place in the ancient world where it was actually a part of life? I mean, there's myths, like, you know, the Epic of Gilgamesh. Gilgamesh is a myth.
Yeah.
And also, always in those myths, if they go off on their, you know, quests,
yeah,
adventures or whatever, you're, there's always an expectation that they'll come back and,
sure,
help them, you know,
yeah, yeah,
do their duty,
yeah,
have,
yeah,
kids,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
rule the nation. I can't think of any. Is there any other?
Well, probably not. I mean, it's
tradition or culture where,
yeah,
this
happened. It seems. I mean, in a way, it harks back to tribal cultures, to like the witch doctor, shaman kind of figure, where you did have like almost like a speciality or a calling.
Yeah, but that was more like a profession. They still sort of went home to their hut and their wife.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So
you
it's
know,
just,
it wasn't as if you just cut off that completely.
No.
You know, in this Sanana tradition, you know, it's very, very clear, one or the other.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's just, there's a connection there, but as you say, it's not the same.
Mm-hmm.
But there would also be a connection with the philosophical tradition in Greece, where you had various kinds of philosophical orders, some of whom may have been celibate.
Right.
And so you did have various kinds of mystical priesthoods and things like that. Although, as you say, it's definitely much more clearly and centrally a characteristic of Indian religious life. Yeah. And
it's not...
Maybe, yeah. Yeah.
More differentiated way of living, not having maybe 10 people in one town, where actually everyone has to have a family, has to keep everything alive. If you have lots of people, big cities, then you can actually spare those people not having families.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the like a mechanism that the society has to deal with, is to how to get rid of surplus, how to burn off surplus, and a lot of times they would do it through sacrifices. And the Buddhist version of that is to support the Sangha. Yeah. Societies tend to go through cycles of you know, famine and shortage, and then great surplus, so the Sangha would have kind of sucked up a lot of the excess. Okay, so then Uttara rose from his seat, and after paying homage to the Brahmin Brahmayu, keeping him on his right, he left for the country of the Videhans, where the Blessed One was wandering, travelling by stages. He came to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him, and his courteous and amiable talk was finished. He sat down at one side and looked for the 32 marks of a great man on the Blessed One's body. He saw more or less the 32 marks, except for two. I'm just trying to see what the... Yevhuyena for the most part, yeah. He was doubtful and uncertain about two of the marks and could not decide and make up his mind about them, about the male organ being enclosed in a sheath and about the largeness of the tongue. Okay. So the male organ... The male organ enclosed in a sheath, and the pahuta jiha is the large tongue. Then it occurred to the Blessed One, this Brahman student sees more or less 32 marks except for two, he cannot make his mind up about them. Then the Blessed One worked such a feat of supernormal power that the Brahman Uttara saw the Blessed One's male organ was enclosed in a sheath. Next, the Blessed One extruded his tongue and he repeatedly touched both ear holes and both nostrils. And he covered the whole of his forehead with his tongue. Now, you might think that that's somewhat amusing, and obviously you do, but you haven't read the scholarly discussion of it yet, okay? So let's see what Venerable Analia has to say about this, blah, blah, blah. So far, we haven't had much difference in Analia's version, so I haven't referred to it. Analia makes the point that there are discourses where the Buddha was not recognized. So clearly, whatever these marks are, they don't, they're not kind of physical deformities or anything like that. He still looked like a normal person. Where was the... Yeah, we'll come to those. I wanted just to look at those, the first two. I thought that there was some discussion here. And maybe it's later on. We maybe discuss it later on when we're discussing the actual marks themselves. Okay, so maybe we just go on to look at the marks themselves. We'll come back to those ones as we get to them. Now, Uttara thought, but suppose I were to follow the recluse Gotama and observe his behavior. He followed the Blessed One for 7 months like a shadow, never leaving him. I think some of the other versions say 3 months and different periods of time. Then at the end, in 7 months in the country of Videha, he sent out on a journey to Mithila, where the Brahman Brahmayu was. Brahmayu asked him, is the report that's been spread about Master Gotama true or not, and is Master Gotama one such as this or not? So this is very interesting in itself, that if they really wanted to find that out, it took 7 months of close personal study to come to a conclusion. So that's kind of interesting. Okay, so then we come to the actual 32 marks themselves. So the first one, Master Gotama sets his foot down squarely. So of course we've got Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. This is a mark of a great man. So the Pali is Suppatitapada. Literally, he's well established on his feet. Okay, pada is a foot. Patitita is to be established or stand. And sup means good. Okay, so that can be, it's fairly vague and can be interpreted in a number of ways. The next one says, on the soles of his feet there are wheels with 1,000 spokes and ribs and hubs all complete. Okay, so This of course is said to be the wheel, as in the wheel turning monarch and so on, is he has a particular sign, and there are other suttas that say that people could see his footprints in the dirt and they could recognise that they're the wheel in the footprints. So it's clearly taken, at least in some places, as being a definite physical mark of the footprint, and of course this being a very common element of Buddhist iconography. They see, especially in early iconography, we see the Buddha Buddha footprint. Buddha-pada is the found quite commonly in different kinds of iconography. So here's one version here from Gandhara, 1st to 2nd century, and with the wheel there.
The wheels and the toes as well.
Yeah, that's the decorations as developed in different ways by the artists.
Does this mean that he had sort of inline scapes, like wheels, rolling along?
No, they're not actually wheels, they're just like, you know, they just look like wheels. Yeah. That's a fairly typical thing. I mean, he seems to have flat feet, and so how they interpret this, or particularly the Pada, is he had flat feet and his toes are all the same kind of length. Black for the Pada. Oh, that's a very big one. There's another one here. And so then they gradually came to incorporate all these different kinds of things. So he's got conch shells for his toes. It's quite nice. That's obviously not meant to be a literal thing. Wow, that's a pair of feet. Look at that, eh? That's awesome. Wow. And this was swastikas and fish and stuff on his feet. So,
that's
a
nice
thing. Yeah, that's Buddha. And so, anyway, there's just a few different representations. So, what we're seeing here, obviously, is a relationship between the text that we've been reading and the development of Buddhist iconography. And this is a complex relationship which has been a fertile field of investigation for those interested in Buddhist iconography, to see exactly how the Buddhist 32 marks and also the 80 minor marks, the 32 are the only canonical ones, but the commentaries and later traditions have 80 minor marks as well. So to see how these have influenced the development of iconography. Obviously in this case it's developed the iconography fairly obviously. In other ones, we don't seem to see that many images of the Buddha licking his ear holes. So, since there was a certain selectiveness there in terms of the use of these things. He has projecting heels. What exactly that means, a bit difficult to say. Many of these slightly obscure in the Pali as well. He has long fingers and toes. His hands and feet are soft and tender. He has netted hands and feet. Jala. So it's a bit controversial whether this means you have webbed hands and feet. And the later tradition argues about that. Some say that he had like a symbol of a net or something on there in the lines. Others that he had a genuine sort of was in the Chinese translation of this text, I believe it says something like webbed like a goose king. His feet are arched.
They certainly were flat before.
So again, some of them being difficult to see how they can be reconciled. He has legs like an antelope's. Okay. What's an antelope? An antelope or a deer. Yeah, this is what you see in this is an interesting one from a historical point of view, because the Yeah, well, it's probably more like a kind of idealized Aslak rather than an actual one. Okay, when he stands without stooping, the palms of both his hands touch and rub against his knees. Yeah, this is kind of a distortion, because if you actually stand like that, you've got your hands kind of halfway up your legs. So he's either a bit like a gorilla or something. Or that is, there's another one that says he's proportioned like a banyan tree, which means that you're actually equally proportioned all around, like an ordinary human. So these two seem to be contradictory. His male organ is enclosed in a sheath, and he's the colour of gold. His skin has a golden sheen. His fine skin, because of the fineness of his skin, dust and dirt do not stick on his body. Okay, so this being one of the traditional sort of Buddhological beliefs that he didn't really have to bathe or clean himself, but he just did to set a good example to others. His body hairs grow singly, each body hair growing alone in a hair socket.
Sometimes
they can't. Usually, but I think it's saying that they're always. Uttara must have examined every single one.
That's why it took 6 months.
Exactly. Thank you for that, Annie. The tips of his body hairs turn up. The upturned body hairs are blue-black, the colour of collyrium, curled and turned to the right. Okay, yes. He has the straight limbs of a Brahma. He has the seven convexities, which, according to the commentaries, the seven are the backs of the four limbs, the two shoulders, and the trunk. He has the torso of a lion. The furrow between his shoulders are filled in. He has the spread of a banyan tree. The span of his arms equals the height of his body, and the height of his body equals the span of his arms. So this one being quite contradictory with the earlier one about the length of his arms. His neck and his shoulders are even. His taste is supremely acute. Well, yeah, again, this one being difficult to know how anyone would know.
Dilute chili, and he could taste it.
And they asked him about it. Yeah, they could. They could have done, except they didn't actually have chili in the time of the Buddha.
That's true. But I don't understand the one before that. What does it mean? His neck and shoulders are even.
Samawatta kandho.
How does that look like?
Well, maybe he's not hunchbacked or something like that. And he's just kind of. Well, it just means it's got straight and even shoulders, huh? Yeah. He is lion-jawed, presumably, as Analia notes, apparently, seriously, that it doesn't mean that he doesn't have, he has fangs. He has 40 teeth. His teeth are even.
40 teeth is extremely.
How many do we normally have?
32.
Mm.
And that's evolutionary. That's 8 extra teeth. That's a lot. Some people have 4 extra.
So 40 being a number of perfection.
Okay.
Yeah, the it's 4 times 10.
32 is a good number.
32 is also a good number, I have to admit, yeah.
Yeah.
His teeth
it's just ordinary though.
It probably would have been more kind of meaningful in those days, because people would have lost their teeth so often.
Yeah.
Yeah, most people by the time they get to be a bit old would probably only have about 10 or so left. Mm-hmm. So to say you've got 40 of them, wow, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah,
his teeth are even, without gaps, and very white.
Well, quite white.
Quite white. No, that's quite what it means, very white. Susuka. Very white. He has a large tongue. He has a divine voice like the call of the Karavika bird. His eyes are deep blue.
Blue? That's incredible.
Abhinila Netto. Probably blue-black. He has the eyelashes of an ox. He's a bit like a kind of sphinx or echidna or something like that. There's all these different things. He has hair growing in the space between his eyebrows, which is white with the sheen of soft cotton. His head is shaped like a turban. Onhisa siso. Okay, so there's the 32 marks, and as you can see, most of them, allowing that way of description of human features is very characteristic of Indian literature, and you constantly find that, for example, in descriptions of women in the literature, it'll always say that their neck is like a swan, or their eyes are like a doe, or something. So comparing bodily parts with animals is a very normal thing. Most of the marks, I think, should probably be interpreted as straightforward signs of physical beauty, just a kind of black hair and white teeth and blue eyes and so on, golden skin. A few of them obviously a bit more curious as to what is actually going on here. So let's just have a look through Venerable Analeo's discussion. He doesn't discuss all the marks, but he does discuss a few of them. The thousand-spoked wheel, according to the Mahavastu, which is a Mahasangika biography or hagiography of the Buddha, the soles of the feet of the Buddha are moreover decorated with swastikas. And regarding the thousand-spoked wheel, the individual translation, which is the Chinese T, what is it, the T, T76, in his translation, at a later point of his narration, narrates that the wheel mark produced by the Buddha's footprints would keep on shining for 7 days and become the object of people's worship. Okay, so when he steps on the ground, the ground glows and shines for 7 days. The individual translation introduces this description of the after effect of the Buddha's footprint by describing that when the Buddha would go for a walk, flowers and treasures rained from the sky and birds and spirits would not dare to fly above him. This narration shows a tendency to proliferate and embellish the Buddha's qualities. Tendencies which, though in less blatant forms, can be seen at work in all three versions of the Brahmayu Sutta. So now some of the interesting things here is that the connection between the shining of the footprints suggests that the footprints may have originally been a solar symbol. Okay, so that's why there's the association with the sun, is the wheel turning, the wheel, which of course appears in the sky, and the swastika itself is often identified as a solar symbol because of the rays of the swastika are like the rays of the sun. So this may be an indication here. The flowers and so on are more generic items of devotion and so on. The idea that the birds and spirits would not dare to fly above him is not that dissimilar from various kinds of taboos for holy men and kings and so on in many countries. For example, in Japan, where they'd carry an umbrella over the king whenever he went outside so that he wouldn't be polluted by the touch of the sun. And if you read in Venerable Dhammika's Broken Buddha, gives several examples of monks who wouldn't walk into a room when there were lay people, especially lay women, in the rooms above. So the same kind of taboos were going on. Okay, when describing the length and softness of the Buddha's hands and feet, the Pali version indicates his hands, fingers and toes were netted. the word being jala. Commentary draws attention to a venia regulation according to which someone whose fingers and toes are webbed together by skin should not be ordained. Okay, now it's a different word here, panahattakam. Pana meaning more literally like hooded or webbed. So it might not necessarily refer to the same thing. The commentary concludes, however, that the reference to the Buddha's netted fingers and toes should therefore not be taken literally, but should be understood to indicate that his feet and hand were marked with lines. Majjhima Agama version presents more literal interpretation as it compares Buddha's netted fingers and toes to a goose. In any case, just to note that the interpretation of these things as either literal physical marks or as symbolic qualities was obviously alive in ancient times, and the Buddhist tradition was never really able to settle down on this too much. Of course, the tendency in the Mahayana sutras was to see these things as all being symbolic. Now, Anaya goes on to then make an interesting argument, but one which should be considered before being accepted. This imagery suggests that the Buddha's... Sorry, such an interpretation perhaps arose from a misunderstanding of a feature found on Buddha statues. As sculpture makers tend to weld the fingers and toes together in order to avoid their breaking off. Banerjee has examined in 1930 this feature in the light of early Indian sculptures and concludes that the idea that the Buddha had a sort of skin between his fingers and toes is due to being misled by a simple craftsman's device. So now this again is speaking to the interconnection between the texts as we have them and the iconography, and the degree to which the iconography reflects the text. It's well known in studies of mythology that these kinds of mistakes do get made, and in Greek history there are many examples and other versions of history where features which are found on statues or found in drawings and so on were then interpreted and became the basis for their own whole mythology. Now, the problem here is that the Buddha was not represented by iconography in the early period, and the first Buddha images are attested probably 500 years or so after the Buddha's life. So if we are to accept this argument, we would have to think that this list of the 32 marks dates from 500 years or longer after the Buddha's life. And of course, this being quite contrary to the usual chronology, and since the lists are pretty much the same in the Pali, Chinese and Sanskrit and other versions of them, we would tend to think of them as belonging to the early period and probably pre-Ashokan. And so we would normally understand that the text influenced the iconography rather than the other way around. If these features only appeared in later literature, then it wouldn't be a problem. But at the moment, it does appear to be a problem. So I think Analio's argument there has to be taken with a bit of a grain of salt. It may be the case, but I don't think that on the basis of that speculation that we're required to think that the text itself must be later than the iconographical period.
Doesn't it suffer from a duplication of the peaks? Using the substitution of duplication rather than actually the peaks.
Yeah, well, it could be either. They could have put the mark in as following from the icon. So you have the icon, you think, what does that mean, and then put it in. But it could also be the other way around, as you're saying, that it was the text had another meaning, but then it was interpreted in that way. That is possible. I'm not convinced by the interpretation of it, because the word jala usually means a net. And so it's a bit different from webbing, as in and it's a different word in the vineyard as the webbing between the hands. So I'm not convinced by that. But Anali uses that kind of argument again later on. That's why I went into it in some detail. It's an interesting argument, but yes, it could well go both ways. Okay, the Pali version describes that the Buddha's male organ was enclosed in a sheath, a quality the Chinese versions illustrate with the imagery of a horse. This was one of the two qualities that the Buddha had to revealed to Uttara, as it would not have been possible for Uttara to ascertain this characteristic on his own. Okay, and the translation offered in the Chinese versions from Majjhima Agama 161, the hidden is horse-like, like a good horse king. And the individual translation, T76, says, the hidden is horse-like. Okay? So, it's all a bit kind of weird, isn't it? In a sense, it seems to shift the imagery, like to say that the Buddha's male organ is enclosed in a sheath, in a sense, to me is saying that his masculinity is like hidden, or is almost androgynous, and it's sort of saying that it's not prominent. Whereas to compare him with a horse, seems to be saying quite the opposite, and I'm saying that it's very prominent. More of a sort of claim as to the Buddha's virility rather than anything else. Okay, the Brahmayu Sutta and its two Chinese parallels agree on describing that the Buddha's skin was of golden hue and dirt wouldn't adhere to it. And the commentary says that it means he didn't need to wash himself, yet according to the Pali and Chinese versions, Uttara recorded that the Buddha washed his feet and that after a meal he would clean his bowl in such a way that at the same time his hands were being washed. From a commentarial perspective, however, Buddhas do not need to wash their hands and feet, although they may do so in order to set an example to others and to give the lay supporters an opportunity to acquire merits. So again, seeing a development in the Buddhological conceptions. Now, with a bit about touching the knees, the Chinese versions say that their description, he was only able to just touch his knees rather than actually pressing them with the palms of his hands. As to touch one's knees can be done with the fingertips, this would still be possible with an average length of arm. Well, I would disagree with that. When you're standing...
No, very long.
I don't think so.
No.
You can't touch your knee tops.
Some people got very long.
Standing erect. You're on the top of your thigh.
Person can,
without
bending, touch in anatomy books and drawing books, they always say that when you're proportioning out the body, if you always put the hands around about the mid-thigh.
Yeah, mid-thigh.
Yeah.
So I'm not particularly convinced by that. Some others have argued that it originally means sitting. It should have been sitting. If you're sitting cross-legged, then you can indeed touch your knees with your thumbs. So. But there's no textual basis for that. Okay, so the Buddha, a few remarks about the taste and... Okay, so then talking about the head like a turban, and the commentary version says refers to the roundness of the Buddha's head. Chinese versions render the same quality in a way that appears to have a real protuberance in mind. The Pali's a bit unhisa, siso, a bit vague as to what it actually means. The discourses, okay, this seems to have been another misunderstanding caused by a feature found on Buddha images. In ancient Indian art, it appears to have been standard procedure to represent gods and divine beings with long hair, which at times was depicted as being worn in a topknot. Though the discourses leave little doubt that the Buddha was shaven-headed just like other monks, artists soon took to portraying him with long hairs, therefore by giving expression to the semi-divine status he had acquired by their time. The topknot used in such representations appears to then have been misunderstood as an actual protuberance on the Buddha's head, a feature that soon became standard for Buddha images. Again, he's arguing from the iconography to the text. Again, it's similar to remarks to before this. Obviously a relationship between them. but I find it's. Well, it's found that they are used in the Buddhist iconography. Yeah, they were consciously used by the Buddhist sculptors.
Yeah, but I'm saying if the marks themselves, as I said, they keep saying that the influence is the other way around to the Buddha's iconography, to the text. But if the marks are Brahmanical, they're pre-Buddhist.
Yeah.
So why would the Buddha's iconography have any relevance to the marks that they are in the Brahmanical text?
In the Brahmanical text, yeah. They don't exist in any Brahmanical text.
Oh, so this is just, you know that they are, but...
We don't know that they are. We know that the Buddhist texts say that they are.
Yes, I mean, we know that they are, but we don't see them there. We just see them.
No, we don't know that they are. We know that the Buddhist texts say that they are.
No.
We've got there's no evidence that they actually ever have been part of the Brahmanical text. So the way that they appear in the Buddhist text is as fulfilling of a Brahmanical prophecy. Yeah, and it's basically a conversion technique for Brahmins, really, but then came to be used within the Buddhist tradition as a sort of natively Buddhist iconographical thing, and sort of treated in quite some detail in the different commentaries and so on, and consciously used to one degree or another by the sculptors and iconographers. It's not that they always adhered to them strictly, but they were certainly influential.
Yeah, but that makes sense, you know, the iconography is influenced by the text. I'm just questioning an obvious idea that it goes both ways.
Uh-huh.
Because if the Buddhist text claim that it's Brahmanical, then, you know, it's like, it doesn't make sense to me that it's influenced by the iconography, the features, if they are.
Yeah.
The argument that the top knot was misunderstood as an actual protuberance on the Buddha's head.
Mm.
So, say this statue here, that's not his hair on top of his head there, that's actually a lump.
Yeah,
a lump. That's a large lump with a bit of hair on top. That's pushing the bounds of plausibility.
He didn't have hair as a shaved head monk.
But to think that, you know, the Buddhists actually thought that the Buddha had this large deformity on the top of his head. So that it looked like a hat. That's somewhat implausible.
I heard stories that those are snails.
I've heard that too.
That they ramble on his head to protect him. And that someone else told me that because he's so divine, so the first time he shaved his head, then he has to grow and curled and he doesn't have to shave again.
Yeah, well, that's part of the legend that the hair sort of naturally went that way. But so one of the marks was that the hair sort of naturally grows around, curls around to the right. So, you know, so what I was pointing about is that the individual hairs in the paws curl around to the right, but that's very hard to depict in sculpture and iconography. So I think that the whole snail thing is really an attempt originally to depict this sort of curling around to the right thing. Again, probably somewhat misinterpreted and so on in tradition. Yeah.
But artists are always concerned to emphasize the Buddha's beauty. And I guess these marks are also there to emphasize that it's kind of taking beautiful proportions and exaggerating them. So, you know, this is beautiful, and then kind of in the mind you say, oh, this is beautiful, and you get even more of that, must be even more beautiful. So for the people thinking in that way, to think that a large cantrus like lump on the head is something characteristic of their beautiful leader, it's just completely implausible to me.
So it goes on to say that according to various texts indicate that two of the 32 marks weren't visible as such. And the three versions agree the Buddha did not actually show his private parts, but rather created an image of them through a fear of supernormal powers, through a feat of supernormal powers. In order to show the length of his tongue, according to the Pali version, he actually pulled out his tongue to lick his ears, cover his whole face. And the Madhyama Agama version, also depicts this as an act of supernormal power rather than really licking his ears. And Analia notes that it does seem a little bit odd, and this strange demonstration led to a dilemma in the Milinda Panha Nagasena. So the Milinda Panha, of course, being a dialogue or purported dialogue between the Greek king Milinda or Mananda and the monk Nagasena, mostly dating from about 100 BC. Even though Nagasena explained that the Buddha did not show his actual genitals but only an image and made this visible only to his visitor, King Milinda still felt this act of demonstration was improper behaviour. In reply to King Milinda's objections, Nagasena explained that in order to lead beings to awakening, a Tathagata was willing to go even to such an extent. Well, if it's really necessary, then you just do anything that the role requires. This reply by Nagasena invites an interesting perspective on the disclosure of these two characteristics and also on the function of the whole set. The discourses present the science of the 32 characteristics as a Brahmanical law, treating such concern with physical marks as a concern particular to the Brahmins.
So why
does
people care?
Hang on, we'll just read through a little bit more and then we'll see if we get any answers to that. The Brahmajala Sutta goes even so far as to reckon the art of making predictions based on physical marks of a person as an animal knowledge and as a wrong type of livelihood. According to the Mahavastu, again this is the Mahasangika biography of the Buddha, the devas of the pure abodes taught the 32 marks of the Brahmins to the Brahmins when the Bodhisattva was about to be born in order to enable them to recognize the Bodhisattva, and the same suggestion is found in the Pali commentaries. So according to the way that the tradition developed it is that even though it was come down from the Brahmanical tradition, it was actually taught by the Brahmins, by the devas of the pure abodes. So it's actually a Buddhist tradition, interestingly enough. So in the discourses, the 32 characteristics are also helped to convert the Brahmins. Prominent Brahmins go to the Buddha and they say that it's beneath their dignity to see a wandering ascetic, and in reply, learned Brahmins highlight the qualities of the Buddha, among others the 32 characteristics. In other words, the early discourses presented that the Brahmins would be convinced to listen to the Samana through hearing about these characteristics, in other words, that he was fulfilling their prophecies. And of course you find exactly the same thing in the Gospels, where Jesus is said to fulfill many of the Old Testament prophecies. And the Lakkhana Sutta of the Digha Nikaya reports that the Buddha also took up the topic of these 32 characteristics on his own. The Lakkhana Sutta goes into a lot of detail explaining the particular karmic forces that have led to the creation of these particular marks. And the Lakkhana Sutta is one of the latest of all the suttas in the Digha Nikaya. The Chinese parallel to it doesn't have any of the elaborate descriptions of karma and so on, and even the tradition acknowledges that the verses in the Lakkhana Sutta were added by Ananda rather than the Buddha. So, but just to come back a little bit to some of these other qualities and some of these other points. So clearly within the texts themselves, as Analia points out, they function as a conversion method. There's no mystery about that. Why everybody didn't just think it was a little bit odd is a bit harder to say. Standards of oddness probably have changed. Now Analia has a note here where he talks about in the Sutta Nipata and the Buddha talking about the Brahman Bhavari, also possesses these two characteristics. And that particular passage with the Brahman Bhavari is quite similar to our current one with Brahmayu, in the sense that Bhavari was also a 120-year-old Brahman teacher who sent his students to go and learn about this. and is one of the prime passages on the 32 marks. And the interesting thing, as pointed out long ago in the Pali Text Society Dictionary, is that Bhavari seems to mean Babylonian. Normally, I think it's Bhaveru or something is the word for Babylon in Pali, I believe. And the Bhavari, if you look at the language changes, then V becomes B and R becomes L. Equals L. So they're called standard linguistic changes, V to B and R to L, and so then that's how you get from Bhavari to Babylon. So there's a suggestion, and I think probably a very likely suggestion, that the origin of the 32 marks is actually Babylonian rather than Indian at all, and this may explain perhaps why they're not found in the existing Indic texts, possibly. Not sure, and I'm not sure to what extent there's been serious research on that. However, what is very characteristic, the 32 marks are primarily associated with the wheel-turning monarch and wheel-turning emperor, and the idea of the god-king is in fact highly characteristic of the whole Mesopotamian region and probably originated there. So this is, and the whole solar imagery again is very characteristic of that region. So I think that there's probably reasonably likely that the 32 marks in whole or part originated somewhere in Babylon or somewhere around that region. He's not said to have come from there. He's living in the south of India. It doesn't say where he comes from originally. Yeah.
So even if the name is the same, how does it connect?
It's just a hint, that's all. It's just a hint that the texts are leaving us, that's all. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there any connection between Bavaria in Germany? And
I don't know. Where does the name Bavaria come from? No,
I isn't the German word B-A-Y-E-R. Bavaria is the English translation.
Okay.
Bayern. Bayern.
How do you say Bavaria in German?
Bayern.
Yeah.
Do you know what it means?
It's
beer.
Probably. Beer drinking district, yeah. Well, it could be. I mean, this is Middle East is where they developed beer for the first time, so there could be some connection there. And after a few glasses, then the imagination does start to run riot. I mean, who knows where these things could be going? I don't know.
So is it possible that, like, the concept of the 32 marks or each of the 32 were, say, if they came from Babylon, were just kind of in the background of the culture, and so thought of as indicative of beauty or greatness, and if you put them all together, then you've got the greatest of the great, never made it into the Vedic texts, but was a strong undercurrent that everybody just knew about, and therefore, because everybody knew about it,
No, it's definitely not something that everyone knew about. It's presented as being an esoteric knowledge.
Okay.
Yeah, it's clearly an arcane knowledge. It's presented only to the highest Brahmins, and they were very precious about their knowledge. Yeah. It's also, I mean, it's the whole kind of omenology and so on is also very characteristic of Babylon and all this thing. So, it's just a mystery, and I think that ultimately, I think that the Buddhist tradition and the Buddhological studies of these things have been hampered and limited by the usual problem that most Buddhists are rational and try to depict it in a rational way. And so we end up discussing things like, as we see in Analia's essay, is it really, do you really have to bend over to be able to reach them and so on? Whereas it seems to me that they're probably not susceptible to a rational explanation, that we need to be looking at a mythical and symbolic interpretation, and I don't know if anyone's gone into enough detail to be able to really make too much headway there. The only contribution I have to make myself is that in the Light on Yoga, if anyone's read it, a classic manual of yoga by what's his name? Iyengar. He's got a long footnote on how you can pull out your tongue with iron pincers, slice underneath it with a razor, and then put butter over it to heal it. And if you keep on doing that and pulling your tongue every day, after many weeks you can touch your forehead and your ear holes with your tongue, and then you'll receive liberation and the deathless and various other kinds of benefits from that practice. Not one which is so popular in modern yoga circles.
Just my lived experience in yoga and qigong, I kept noticing how physical yoga practices seem to be like a kind of reverse engineering of inner qigong practices.
Mm-hmm.
So, like for example, the lengthening of the tongue by actually cutting it physically.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, with qigong practices, like a connection between the heart and the tongue, and as you energetically open your heart, your tongue actually gets floppier, more relaxed, more flexible, more speech, more articulate. So, and actually, your tongue does get a bit bigger. So, for me, perhaps there's an inner yoga thing going on with these little lines.
Yeah, yeah. Could well be. I mean, I think that's one aspect of it which should be investigated. But yeah, hard to. Maybe you can lengthen your arms through yoga practice as well. But anyway, still very mysterious. It has been investigated to some degree by Buddhologists and so on, but still quite mysterious. Okay. Then we go to the description, which is actually, I think, probably more interesting and more characteristic of our particular sutta, of the Buddha's actual behaviour, which is whereas the 32 marks commonly found in many suttas, the description of the Buddha's behaviour and so on is only found in this particular place. When he walks, he steps out with the right foot first. He does not extend his foot too far or put it down too near. He walks neither too quickly nor too slowly. He walks without his knees knocking together. He walks without his ankles knocking together. He walks without raising or lowering his thighs, or bringing them together or keeping them apart. When he walks, only the lower part of his body oscillates, and he does not walk with bodily effort. When he turns to look, he does so with his whole body, looking the famous elephant look. He does not look straight up. He does not look straight down. Okay, when he does not walk looking about, he looks a plow yoke's length before him. Beyond that, he has unhindered knowledge and vision. Okay, so this is referring to, especially in the village and so on, to walk with eyes restrained is one of the Sekhya rules. And the plow yoke's length, more or less about 4 meters or so in front of one. Normally, keeping the eyes downcast. And so according to this, he can see, like for most of us, you know, you can walk around with your eyes downcast all you like, but then when it comes to crossing the road or something like that, then you have to look around, otherwise you'll get run over. Because the Buddha didn't have to do that, because he just used his psychic powers to know where the cars were. When he goes indoors, he does not raise or lower his body or bend it forward or back. He turns round neither too far from the seat nor too near it. He does not lean on the seat with his hand. He does not throw his body down on the seat. When seated indoors, he does not fidget with his hands. He does not fidget with his feet. He does not sit with his knees crossed. Yeah, something like that, I guess. Huh? Yeah.
Even the other day when I noticed Virginia and Austin, they don't sit with crossed knees, they just
He does not sit with his ankles crossed. He does not sit with his hand holding his chin. When seated indoors, he is not afraid. He does not shiver and tremble. He is not nervous. Being unafraid, not shivering or trembling or nervous, his hair does not stand up, and he is intent on seclusion. When he receives the water for the bowl, he does not raise or lower the bowl or tip it forwards or backwards. He receives neither too little nor too much water for the bowl. So it seems he's referring probably to a tradition where after the meal that somebody would come and actually pour water into the bowl for washing for you. He washes the bowl without making a splashing noise. He washes the bowl without turning it around. Okay, so you hold the bowl still and wash inside rather than moving the bowl around. He does not put the bowl on the floor to wash his hands. When his hands are washed, the bowl is washed, and when the bowl is washed, his hands are washed. So that just means that when you finish washing, that both your bowl and your hands are clean. It doesn't mean that you wash your bowl hands into the bowl, this being another secular rule you shouldn't do. He pours the water for the bowl neither too far nor too near, and he does not pour it about. When he receives rice, he does not raise or lower the bowl or tip it forwards or backwards. He receives neither too little rice nor too much rice. He adds sauces in the right proportion. He does not exceed the right amount of sauce in the mouthful. Okay, so this being again one of the Sakya rules that is a sign of greed to have too much curry or something like that with the rice. He turns the mouthful over two or three times in his mouth and then swallows it. No rice kernel enters his body unchewed. I'm not quite sure how Udra was able to observe that. And no rice kernel remains in his mouth, and then he takes another mouthful. He takes his food experiencing the taste, though not experiencing greed for the taste. The food he takes has eight factors. It is neither for amusement, nor for intoxication, nor for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the endurance and continuance of this body, for the ending of discomfort, and for assisting the holy life. He considers, thus, I shall terminate old feelings without arising new feelings, and I shall be healthy and blameless, and shall live in comfort. And, of course, this being the standard reflection on the alms food. When he's eaten and receives water for the bowl, he does not raise or lower the bowl or tip it forwards or backwards. Okay, so the previous one must have been receiving the water for rinsing the bowl before the meal, and now it's washing it after the meal. He receives neither too little nor too much water for the bowl. He washes the bowl without making a splashing noise. He washes the bowl without turning it around. He does not put the bowl on the floor to wash his hands. When his hands are washed, the bowl is washed, and when the bowl is washed, his hands are washed. He pours the water for the bowl neither too far nor too near, and he does not pour it about. When he is eaten, he puts the bowl on the floor neither too far nor too near, and he is neither careless of the bowl nor overly solicitous about it. So you can see all of these things, it's basically all middle way, yeah, in everything. That it's just not too much and not excessive. Everything that he does is just very natural and very even. So I think this is very important. I mean, we'll keep on going to have a look at some of the more of them, but one of the things that really comes across to me from this description is this sort of sense of natural gracefulness that he does these things in a very kind of, it's incredibly ordinary that he's doing everything, but there's a specialness to the way that ordinary things are done with such a sense of grace and so on. And it's very unpretentious and it's very un-anything. And so it's one of the things I think I always get a little bit suspicious of when we see sort of practices that are then getting very, very extreme, like doing everything very, very slow, kind of the slow walking and so on. And it says it's neither too fast nor too slow. And so this is always a good... They still do that in the Sri Lankan tradition. They'll actually come to you with a bowl, and then they'll put some in your bowl for you. And then if you've had enough, you just put your hand over the bowl, and that means that you've had enough. So that's a good thing to know for when you're having dana, especially in Sri Lankan. The way we receive dana here is more or less a Thai system, where you receive it and then help yourself. Sri Lankan system usually, they'll come to you with the bowl, and they'll bring all the dishes, and they'll put it with a spoon, And that the etiquette is that when you've got enough, you just put your hand over the bowl like that, and then they'll know that that's enough. Yeah. And they'll often come up to you again during the meal itself, and bring and see if you want anything extra and so on. So again, if you take anything, or just put the hand over just to indicate you've had enough.
With the water that went into the bowl before the meal, they also washed your hands with?
So again, they'd always wash your hands before the meal because they're eating with the hands.
Didn't you say that there's a rule about not washing your hands in the bowl?
Yeah, so you don't like put the bowl there and pour the washing water and then just pour the dregs of your hand washing water into the bowl, stream the bowl like a spittoon. And then you swishel it around. So that's very water efficient. So
the first half of this sutta focuses on the kind of the more physical thing.
Yeah.
And then the second half is more about the actual behavior and mindfulness. So do you think that the second part was kind of slightly more authentic and they kind of just match the other physical things?
Well, could well be, yeah. The passages on the 32 marks is definitely a standard passage, and with those standard passages, they're very easy to just slot them in there. So it could well be the case, yeah.
And it seems that people associate the kind of the physical look with how spiritually advanced you are. I read in the Samyutta that the Buddha actually points to someone with a big nose, and I say to the bhikkhus, even though he has a big nose, but he's actually enlightened.
Yeah, that's right. It's the first Western monk. Yeah. Uh-huh, coming up, tall and skinny with a big nose. And then there's the deformed dwarf and things like that as well. Yeah. So absolutely, yeah. From a Buddhist point of view, is that enlightenment isn't to do with your physical appearance, but again, what this is pointing to is not so much the question of enlightenment. So, for example, even like the Cheka Buddhas and so on wouldn't have all of these 32 marks, but it's more to do with his role as a world teacher. Yeah. So as the Buddha, as the world teacher. So in that sense, he's somebody as the fulfillment of the Brahmanical prophecies was somebody who they would accept as their teacher. And this is what we see all the time. So originally it's not really a Buddhist endorsement of these values, but more or less using it as to establish the possibility of the Buddha being the teacher of the Brahmins as well.
Mentality is quite common in like Chinese Buddhism. So they see someone who has a big ear or something, they think you're going to be a really good looking practitioner. That's something that
Yeah, definitely. There's that kind of movement, you know. And as you said, you don't get that in the actual, you know, serious doctrinal suttas, but it's obviously a very common part of the kind of the popular culture in India and in China and so on as well. Yeah.
I thought that was another sutta describing a lot of practices Buddha went through when he was a Buddhist to get all these 32 marks.
That's right. That's in the Lakkhana Sutta in the Digha Nikaya.
Yeah.
As I mentioned that briefly before, and the Lakkhana Sutta is really only found in the Pali tradition. There's no cognate suttas in the other tradition, so it's clearly a very late sutta. It's probably one of the latest of all the Pali suttas. But that does identify the particular karmic acts in the past that have resulted in particular features. Yeah. So it's a very interesting sutta. The German monk, there's a curious kind of twist of fate. The German monks really like that sutta because Helmut Hecker, a great German scholar, did a lengthy study and an analysis of that particular sutra. I think he took it away on retreat. I think he was kind of motivated by the fact that it was one of the most outlandish and irrational of all the Pali canon suttas. And so he thought, no, obviously I don't understand this well enough. So he went away on a long retreat and just took this particular sutta with him. And then sort of developed this whole kind of system of interpreting that particular sutta, which I know Venerable Jhatamalo and some of the other German monks are very impressed by. So, but I'm not sure if that doesn't exist in English. The Lakana Sutta, yeah.
The Nikayas seem a bit like the New Testament to the Old Testament. That, you know, converting Brahmins and redefining what a Brahmin is, and in the same way that's, you know, difficult to understand the New Testament without the Old Testament, it's difficult to understand the Nikayas without knowing the Vedas.
Yeah, very much so, yeah. Except, you know, the Buddha clearly saw himself as outside of the Vedic tradition and basically just rejecting it, whereas Jesus was a bit more ambiguous in his relationship to it. So when he's eaten, he sits in silence for a while, but he does not let the time for the blessing go by. So this is the Anumodana. Typically in those days, of course, the Anumodana wasn't just a chant that was, we do it today, but it would have been a short teaching. And as it says here, it was done at the end of the meal, rather than we follow the Thai tradition here where it's done at the beginning. When he has eaten and gives the blessing, he does not do so criticizing the meal or expecting another meal, right? Oh, virtuous lay followers, you have made such good merit by offering the ice cream and the chocolate cake today, and not quite such good merit by offering the lentil soup. And if you'd really like to to rejoice in the higher realms of the Tusita heaven, then definitely you should consider offering pizza on a more regular basis. So this is the kind of thing which he didn't do. He instructs, urges, rouses and gladdens that audience with talk purely on the Dhamma. When he has done so, he rises from his seat and departs. He walks night. So, of course, a lot of focus on the Buddha in his behaviour at the house and invitations and mealtime, which, of course, being the time when Uttara would have got the access to be able to actually see him. He walks away neither too fast nor too slow. He does not go as one who wants to get away. His robe is worn neither too high nor too low on his body, nor too tight nor too loose, nor does the wind blow his robe away from his body. So this is something to be tested at Santi Monastery in September and October. And we go out for alms round, and sometimes the winds are up to like 100 k's or something like that out the front. And
you said there's never too tight.
No, there's never too tight because they always loosens up. Yeah, in theory there's too tight, but in practice it doesn't really work. Dust and dirt do not soil his body, as we mentioned before, this being one of the hagiographical elements. When he is gone to the monastery, he sits down on a seat made ready. Having sat down, he washes his feet, although he does not concern himself with grooming his feet. So it's kind of interesting that in these days there's a Buddhist tradition which is quite a beautiful tradition of washing the feet of people when they return from an alms round and so on, which we would do always in Thailand, and we've done sometimes here. People will organise that, but it seems like in the Buddhist day that he would wash his own feet. And when sitting down, having washed his feet, he seats himself cross-legged, sets his body erect, and establishes mindfulness in front of him. He does not occupy his mind with self-affliction or the affliction of others or with the affliction of both. He sits with his mind set on his own welfare, on the welfare of others and on the welfare of both, even on the welfare of the whole world. When he's gone to a monastery, he teaches the Dhamma to an audience. He neither flatters nor berates that audience. He instructs, urges, rouses and encourages it with talk purely on the Dhamma. The speech that issues from his mouth has 8 qualities. It is distinct, intelligible, melodious, audible, ringing, euphonious, deep, and sonorous. But while his voice is intelligible as far as the audience extends, his speech does not issue out beyond the audience. which is a good thing to bear in mind for some of the temples who like to broadcast the Dhamma on their PA systems and things like that. So when the temple has, when the people have been instructed, urged, roused and gladdened by him, they rise from their seats and depart, looking only at him and concerned with nothing else. We have seen Master Gotama walking, sir. We've seen him standing. We've seen him entering indoors. We've seen him indoors seated in silence. We've seen him eating indoors. We've seen him seated in silence after eating. We have seen him giving the blessing after eating. We've seen him going to the monastery. We've seen him in the monastery seated in silence. We've seen him in the monastery teaching the Dhamma to an audience. Such is the Master Gotama. Such he is, and more than that. When this was said, Brahman Brahmayu rose from the seat, and after arranging his upper robe on one shoulder, he extended his hands in reverential salutation towards the Blessed One and uttered this exclamation three times: honour to the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened, which of course Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Perhaps sometime or other we might meet Master Gotama, perhaps we might have some conversation with him. So just come over to...
Do you know where he's at? He's sending his hands towards him, so he wasn't actually there. So the general direction of where he came from.
Yeah, I guess he would have known the general direction. Yeah, so there's no really interesting variations between the different versions in that particular account. They've been quite consistent. Then in the course of his wandering, the Blessed One eventually arrived at Mithila. The Blessed One lived at Makha Deva's mango grove. Brahmin householders heard about that he was living there, and so they decided to go and see him. Some paid homage to the Blessed One, sat down at one side, some exchanged greetings with him, and when this courteous and amiable talk was finished, sat down at one side. Some extended their hands in reverential salutation towards him and sat down at one side, and some pronounced their name and clan in the Blessed One's presence and sat down at one side. Some kept silent and sat down at one side. Of course, this being the indication of the different degrees of devotion or respect that the different members of the audience have for the Buddha.
What's the extending
hands? Oh, just making Anjali. So then Brahmayu went to Makadeva's mango grove with a number of Brahmin students. When he came to the mango grove, he thought, it is not proper that I should go to the recluse Gotama without first being announced. Then he told one of his students, come and go and ask him my name, whether Gotama is free from illness and affliction, and healthy, strong and abiding in comfort, and then tell him that about me, that I'm old and learned in the Vedas and so on. And say that of all the Brahmin householders who live in Mithila, the Brahmin Brahmayu is pronounced the foremost among them in wealth, in knowledge of the hymns, and in age and fame. And he wants to see Master Gotama. So he went and told the Buddha, the young student went to tell the Buddha this, and the Buddha said, let him come when it's convenient for him. The student went back to see Brahmayu. He said, Blessed One says it's okay, so he came. When the assembly saw him coming in the distance, and they at once made way for him, remembering that we have a student, this audience of most of the other Brahmins from the region, and they made way for him as for one who was well known and famous. Then the Brahmin Brahmayu said to the assembly, enough, sirs, let each sit down in his own seat. I shall sit here next to the recluse Gotama. He went to exchange greetings with him, sat down on one side, and looked for the 32 marks. But again was doubtful about the 2 marks. Then he addressed the Blessed One in verses. Okay, the 32 marks I learned that are the signs of a great man. It's a very different translation from the one we have here. Oh no, it's the same. Yeah, there's a lot more verses here. Anyway, 32 marks that I learned that are the marks of a great man. I still do not see 2 of these upon your body, Gotama. Is what should be concealed by cloth hid in a sheath? Greatest of men, though called by a word of feminine gender, perhaps your tongue is a manly one. Right? So the word jivha is tongue in Pali, is a feminine word, but he's saying perhaps you've got a manly tongue. Perhaps your tongue is large as well, according to what we have been taught. Please put it out a little bit, and so, O seer, cure our doubt for welfare in this very life and happiness in lives to come. And now we crave for leave to ask something that we aspire to know. And so the Buddha again did his trick with the psychic powers and covering his ears and forehead with the tongue. And then he spoke the following verses, which are back here, this translation. The 32 marks you learned that are the signs of a great man all on my body can be found. So Brahman, doubt no more on that. What must be known, I've directly known. What must be developed, I have developed. What must be abandoned, I have abandoned. Therefore, Brahman, I am a Buddha. For welfare in this very life and happiness in lives to come, since leave is given you, please ask whatever you aspire to know. The previous lines, it says, whatever is to be known, I've directly known. So this refers to the Four Noble Truths. What is to be developed is the Eightfold Path, and what is to be abandoned is the defilements that lead to rebirth. And so this inviting the Brahman to ask whatever he wanted, this is said to be a special power of the Buddha, that he can say, ask anything you like and I can give you an answer. And then Brahmayu thought, what should I ask him about? The good in this life or the good in the lives to come? So interesting that this dichotomy parallels the basic dichotomy from the start of the sutta, the choice of to live as a wheel-turning monarch or to live as a become a Buddha. So he's talking about the worldly good or the spiritual good. And so it's a similar kind of distinction being made here. And he thought, I'm skilled in the good of this life, and others too ask me about this. Why shouldn't I ask him only about the good in the lives to come? Now, this being interesting because we often associate a priestly role as being precisely to know about the good in lives to come, whereas the Brahmanical tradition, as he says here, is mainly founded on the good in this life, actually, and the concern with future lives is in the Vedas fairly marginal. So then ask a series of questions. How does one become a Brahman, and how does one attain to knowledge? How does one have the triple knowledge, and how is one called a holy scholar? How does one become an Arahant? How does one attain completeness? How is one a silent sage, and how is one a Buddha? Yeah, well, he's kind of, well, this is like endless persons at the conferences and discussions and so on, and then they're invited to ask one question, and they come up to the microphone and then spend the next 15 minutes giving their life story and philosophy of the universe and a whole list of questions.
Not even asking a question.
This is a beginning of a long tradition. Anyway, he's fairly brief. So how does one become a Brahman? Who knows about his former lives, sees heaven and states of deprivation, and has arrived at birth destruction, a sage who knows by direct knowledge, who knows that his mind is purified, entirely freed from every lust, who has abandoned birth and death, who is complete in the holy life, and who has transcended everything. One such as this is called a Buddha. Okay, so he seems to have only answered the last question. But according to the commentary, it gives an extensive and complicated explanation of how the Buddha's reply actually answers all eight of Brahmayu's questions, which we don't need to know in detail. Okay, so just to see what the come back. Okay, in the Madhyama Agama version said that the Buddha wanted to teach him the Abhidhamma, which is probably somewhat anachronistic. Okay, so in both versions, Brahmayu inquires about the significance of various epithets that describe a spiritually accomplished person. The three versions vary on the epithets used by Brahmayu. The Pali version has 8, Madhyama Agama version has 4, and the independent translation has 5. The Pali version begins with Brahmayu's asking after the implications of a true Brahman, a quality found in both Chinese parallels. The Pali and the Madhyama Agama version agree that Brahmayu also inquired after one who has the three knowledges. And the Pali version and the individual translation agree on including the epithet Buddha in the account of the Brahmayu's question. So all the Chinese versions actually give an answer to the question, what's a true Brahman? Which is that by overcoming evil and practicing the holy life, one deserves to be reckoned a Brahman. While the individual translation indicates that possessions of the three knowledges makes one a Brahman. Even though the Pali version, only the Pali version records Brahmayu asking after the implications of being a Muni, the Madhyama Agama version offers an explanation of this term similar to the Pali version's reply. And so it seems to have lost the question from the Madhyama Agama version. While in the Pali version, the reply to what makes a true Brahman seems to be missing, so that both versions, the verse exchange between Brahmayu and the Buddha does not seem to be presented in full. In spite of variations in regard to terminology in all three versions, this exchange with Brahmayu led from an examination of the physical manifestations of a superior being to the Buddha's explanation of what really makes one a superior being, introducing thereby a redefinition, perhaps a revaluation of the Mahapurisa, reflected also in other Pali discourses. Okay, so this of course being the basic trend of the Buddhist approach was to criticize merely physical and even behavioral definitions of perfection and to focus on the inner awakening. The phrases used here by Brahmayu in his questions, given the Pali of it, given here by Analio, the true Brahman, one who has the highest knowledge, attained to knowledge, is a Vedagu. Vedagu meaning the literal explanation of it being one who is learned in the three Vedas, the threefold knowledge, the Te Vidya, having a similar meaning, one is learned in the three Vedas, and the one that Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as a holy scholar, Sotya, being a stage of Brahmanical studentship, an arahant, accomplished one, Kevali, also being a standard term for an awakened being, Kevala meaning entire or complete, Kevalin being more commonly used in some of the other traditions like Jainism and so on. Muni is a term which is often translated as a silent stage and connected with the idea of moneya and silence in the Buddhist tradition, although it's interesting that the etymology of it is somewhat disputed, and the earliest references to it in the Rig Veda actually talk about the Munis who making a bloody great racket and annoying everybody by their noise. So it's interesting that that comes to mean a silent sage. Okay, so when this was said, the Brahman Brahmayu rose from his seat, and after arranging his upper robe on one shoulder, he prostrated himself with his head at the Blessed One's feet, and he covered the Blessed One's feet with kisses and caressed them with his hands, pronouncing his name, I am the Brahman Brahmayu, Master Gotama, I am the Brahman Brahmayu, Master Gotama, being very similar to the display by King Dasenadi in the Dhammacetia Sutta we read a few weeks ago. Those in the assembly wondered and marvelled, and sorry, that particular bit about kissing the Buddha's feet and so on is not found in the Chinese versions. Those in the assembly wondered and marvelled, and they said, it's wonderful, it's marvellous. Ah, what great power and great might the recluse Gotama has for the well-known and famous Brahman Brahmayu to make such a display of humility. And then the Buddha said, enough, Brahman, sit in your own seat, since your mind has confidence in me. Brahman Brahmayu then rose and sat in his own seat. The Blessed One then gave him talk on the progressive instruction, Anupubhikata. That is, talk on giving, talk on virtue, talk on the heavens. He explained the danger, degradation and defilement in sensual pleasures and the blessing of renunciation. When he knew that the Brahman Brahmayu's mind was ready, receptive, free from hindrances, elated and confident, he expounded to him the teaching special to the Buddhas, suffering, its origin, its cessation and the path. Just as a clean cloth with all marks removed would take dye evenly, so too, while the Brahman Brahmayu sat there, the spotless, immaculate vision of the Dhamma arose in him. All that is subject to arising is subject to cessation. Then the Brahman Brahmayu saw the Dhamma, attained the Dhamma, understood the Dhamma, fathomed the Dhamma. He crossed beyond doubt, did away with perplexity, gained intrepidity, and became independent of others in the teacher's dispensation. And this, of course, being always the standard passage on attainment of stream entry, this particular textual block being found repeatedly, especially in the Vinaya in the first chapter of the Khandakas, but also frequently elsewhere. Curiously enough, even though the topics which the Buddha talks about there, giving, virtue, the heavens, danger, degradation and defilement and sense pleasures and so on, even though these are well-known topics which are found many times in the Buddha scriptures, there doesn't seem to be anywhere in any tradition where that gradual teaching is actually found in detail. It's only found presented in the abbreviated form that we have it here. Well, there's examples of the individual parts of the teachings, but not of the thing as a whole, given all in extenso, which is somewhat curious. Then afterwards he said, "Magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent Master Gotama. Master Gotama has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who is lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Gotama for refuge and to the Dhamma and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. From today let Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life. Let the Blessed One together with the Sangha of Bhikkhus consent to accept tomorrow's meal from me." Afterwards, the Buddha accepted, Brahmayu paid homage and left. And the next day he prepared mealtime, of course being the standard passages on these things. And then he went with the Sangha to Brahmayu's residence, and Brahmayu for the next week served and satisfied the Buddha and the Sangha with his own hands. So this being a part of the Buddha's teaching on dana is that the best way to do dana is to actually do it yourself with your own hands. Not to just sort of delegate it to someone. I mean, it's still good dana if you delegate it, but saying to your servants, you know, give the food to the Buddha when he comes is different from making sure that you're there yourself. At the end of that week, the Blessed One set out to wander in the country of the Videhans. Soon after he'd gone, the Brahmin Brahmayu died. Then a number of bhikkhus went to the Blessed One, paid homage to them, and sat down at one side and said, "Venerable Sir, the Brahmin Brahmayu has died. What is his destination? What is his future course?" "Bhikkhus," said the Buddha, "the Brahmin Brahmayu was wise. He entered into the way of the Dhamma, and he did not trouble me in the interpretation of the Dhamma. With the destruction of the five lower fetters, he has reappeared spontaneously in the pure abodes and will there attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world." That's what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So, became a stream enterer while listening to the Buddha, and then apparently shortly afterwards attained to non-return. Now, the slightly curious thing is that... I should just mention that in the Madhyama Agama version... that at the conclusion of the meal the Buddha spoke a set of verses highlighting the superiority of a Buddha, whatever that means, but that's not found. A similar set of verses found at the completion of a meal can be heard in Suttanipata 568-569. The three versions agree that not long after this meal Brahmayu passed away and was declared by the Buddha to have attained non-return. While the Pali version and the individual translation conclude with the monks rejoicing, the Madhyama Agama version reports that Brahmayu also rejoiced in the discourse. Right? This rejoicing cannot refer to the discourse as a whole, since it would be absurd for Brahmayu to rejoice in hearing what happened after he was already dead. I think we can all agree there. Absolutely, to rejoice in your own death after you're already dead. It's something, I mean, I think it, people who do that, they're just absurd. Yeah, well, there are a few cases where devas come back and do it, but anyway, it would seem more meaningful to take the rejoicing to refer to the exposition given by the Buddha to Brahmayu, which maybe originally came at the end of the exposition to give him by the Buddha. And so Analeo suggests that his delighted reaction was originally maybe after the meal time the Buddha taught him, and for the purpose of oral transmission the discourse was then provided with an introduction and a conclusion, narrating its setting and reporting what happened afterwards to Brahmayu. When this was done, the passage on the delighted reaction of the listeners could have been automatically shifted to the end of the discourse, without the reciters noticing that in this way they created an apparent anachronism by having Brahmayu rejoice in hearing the news of his own passing away, which is plausible, although the fact still remains that the there's a difference. Two versions obviously get it right, and only one version Brahmayu's has the textual anachronism there. So whereas the coda describing Brahmayu's death is found in all three versions, so it can't be the case that the mere inclusion of the coda was sufficient by itself to confuse the text in that way. In any case, the main point here is that in the Madhyama Agama tradition, there's quite an obvious mistake in the textual transmission. It's rare to find mistakes that are so obvious. The Pali discourses are usually very well edited, and it's rare that you find that kind of thing. It does happen, it seems, a few more times in the Agama Suttas, and particularly that kind of thing is noted by Thikmin Chao in his study of the Madhyama Agama in a number of contexts. I'm not sure if he lists the different contexts. But they seem to have added, like all of the suttas, they sort of add this thing about the bhikkhus rejoicing in the Blessed One's words. But the suttas found in the Chinese Agamas seem to have been somewhat more mechanical and less sensible in how they applied that. That's applied in some several cases, like this one, where it doesn't really make sense. So this is the Brahmayu Sutta. So I think a very, very lovely sutta, very lovely devotional sutta. And even though we spent quite a bit of time covering the 32 marks of the body, I think the passages describing the Buddha's behaviour are probably the most memorable and distinctive feature of this particular text. And a very, very lovely description of the Buddha's conduct, which is definitely something to be emulated. Okay, so
there's one more question about that. Was that Buddha's contact when he was in the village, but also, or was it a description of Buddha's contact both in monastery and monastery?
Oh, they described both things, yeah. He said, well, this is like this when he's in the house and having the meal, and then he followed him back to the monastery. And But the eating description was primarily in the meal time. Okay, let's finish by paying respects.